As guests mentioned, we do have an awful lot of visitors here tonight, and I just want you to know how much of an encouragement you are to the church, and certainly how much of an encouragement it is to me to see good friends from so many places who've come to be with us, especially to see people like Kyle, who I have known all of his life, and to see how he has grown and developed as a man of God, and to know the good work that he's doing for the kingdom where he is. It's really exciting and encouraging to see him. And it's great to see his mom and dad. I mentioned last night in the lesson on abortion that I was born to a single mother. And because of that, in my life, I desperately needed strong male role models. Men who would take an interest in me and be a father to me. And Jenny's dad, Paul, was certainly that. And I often think, and I think in fear and trembling, of where I would be as a person without Paul and without his family. So it's always great to see them and have some time to be with them. So tonight, as Brother Gist mentioned, I want to tackle another one of the topics that you might say are contemporary social issues that the church has asked me to talk with you about this week. Back in January, I was shocked to log onto my computer and flip on Google News and see this news story. This news story from Washington, D.C., that involves some kids who had traveled there from Covington Catholic High School here in Kentucky. And as the story was reported, these kids had surrounded and harassed this Native American who was more or less just minding his own business. When I saw this picture and when I read that story, I have to tell you that the feeling that came over me was a feeling of absolute rage. So much so that I scrapped what I was planning to talk about the next night at church and furiously started putting together a sermon because I intended to peel the hide off of those kids when I got up into the pulpit. Because it angered me so much that kids from my home state, a state that I feel so blessed to be a part of, the place that I still call home and still think of as home, that it would be kids from Kentucky who would do this. My mom, when the family moved down to Eastern Kentucky, they actually moved up to Northern Kentucky. Mom graduated from Boone County, which is just right up there next door, to Covington. So there's some family connections there. So I was ashamed, I was embarrassed, I was angry. But as the day went on, turns out there was more to the story than meets the eye. It is true that there was a vicious display of racism on this occasion, but as it turns out, it was not on the part of the kids from Covington, it was directed at the kids from Covington. And what I subsequently learned is that there were some other protesters from a fringe religious cult called the Black Israelites, who believe they are the lost 10 tribes of Israel, who had gone there to mock the Native Americans, and they did. They referred to them as savages. They accused them of worshiping a totem pole. And some of the Covington kids had started to gather to jump on a bus, saw what was happening, were confused by it, and then found themselves in the bullseye of the same Black Israelites who began to call them what can only be described as vicious racial epithets and threw in some anti-Catholic bigotry just for good measure. One of the things that was so stunning about all of this is how absolutely upside down the initial reports were, so much so that many mainstream news publications began to try to talk about how did we get this so wrong? Like this story from The Atlantic, the media botched the Covington Catholic story. Well, whatever else we are to take away from that episode back in January, one thing is certainly clear, which is that racism is alive and well in our culture. And it is much bigger and much more widespread than I certainly care to admit. And so what I want to do tonight is follow our course of action so far this week and simply apply the teaching of the Bible to this particular subject. And the place that I want to begin is where we began last night when I talked with you about abortion. I want to begin with just the basic point that Scripture teaches that all human beings are made in the image of God, and because of that, deserve dignity and respect. So we looked last night at this key passage in Genesis 1. Then God said, "Let us make man in our image and after our likeness." We talked about that carries with it the idea of representing God's rule and authority, like a king would set up a statue or an image to remind the populace of who's in charge. We as human beings have that amazing divine mandate to represent and extend the authority of God over the animals. And so we have a special sanctity of life that goes and be above and beyond animals. Last night, I was making the point that this status as image bearers of God is not defined in terms of age. So it is true whether you are an adult, it is true whether you are an infant, it is true whether you are a fetus, if you are a human being, then you have this special status as an image bearer of God. Well, just as age does not make a difference, just as the number on your birth certificate says nothing about your status as an image bearer of God, the same is true with regard to the color of your skin. All human beings, irrespective of race, are made in the image of God and have the same maker. Paul in Acts 17, in the passage we started out with in Bible class on Sunday, says, "The God who made the world and everything in it, being Lord of heaven and earth, does not live in temples made by man, nor is he served by human hands as though he needed anything, since he himself gives to all mankind life and breath and everything." God is the maker of all of us. That's why Paul goes on to say he made from one, and we talked about this in class, one what? Well, he doesn't say, but it's one something. You got to put something in there. So most translations will say he made from one man. The King James and the New King James say he made from one blood, but we get the point, don't we? All of us as humanity share our common origin in God himself, that God has made from one man every nation of mankind to live on the face of the earth. And this is the sense in which we can rightfully say that God is the father of all of us and that all of us are brothers. There is certainly a special sense in which God is our father as our redeemer. And there's a special sense in which we are brothers and sisters as those who have been redeemed by Christ. But there's also a true sense, much more broadly, that simply by virtue of the fact that God is the creator of all of us, that in that broad sense, as the maker of heaven and earth and everything in it, God is the father of all of us. And in that sense, we can also say that all of us share a common heritage in the shared humanity we have created in the image of God. And what that therefore means is that the way we treat one another is a reflection, ultimately, of what we think about God. In James 3, when he talks about the use of the tongue, he says this in verse 9, "With it we bless our Lord and Father, and with it we curse the people who are made in the likeness of God." In other words, with one and the same tongue, we bless the image maker, but curse the image bearer. When you preach, and I'm not sure if you've encountered this a lot, Logan, when you preach, sometimes little children will draw pictures of you. I see many stick figures in your future here in this regard here, right? So one time I was preaching somewhere up in Indiana, and this little girl came out and said, "I drew a picture of you." So she drew a picture of what she thought looked like me. And I can only say that in her mind, I apparently look just like former NBA player Scottie Pippen. And although I wish I could play basketball like Scottie Pippen, if you know who Scottie Pippen was, I think it is fair to say he's not going to win one of those, you know, People Magazine Most Beautiful People of the Year awards. So I looked at that picture and I thought, wow, that's what I look like to you? But of course, the problem is not really the picture, is it? She just didn't have much material to work with, right? So there's the image maker, there was the image bearer,
And if I'm going to talk badly about the image bearer, what I'm really having a problem with is the image maker, right?
James says, how can you curse your brother who's made in the image of God and yet say you praise and worship God? One is the image of the other, and how you treat the image bearer is really what you're saying about the image maker. Now, when you apply that to the issue of racism, the point is obvious. We cannot, with one part of our mouth, say, oh yeah, I believe in God, I love God, I revere God, and at the same time, tear someone down, or curse at someone, or call someone names, because their race might be different, because their race has nothing to do with their being an image bearer of God. And we cannot say that we love God, and we respect God as the image maker, when we do not love and treat kindly those who bear his image. Which is, of course, exactly what racism does. Because what racism says is your dignity and worth as a human being is not defined in terms of being an image bearer of God. Your dignity and worth as a human being instead is determined by your race. And so for some people who like their race, they become inordinately prideful because of it. And then similarly, they become disdainful of others because they have a different race. But in both cases, what is taking place is what defines a person's worth is the color of their skin rather than their creation in the image of God. And in this regard, racism shares an awful lot in common with the pro-abortion rights movement. Because as I talked with you about yesterday, the basis of the abortion rights movement is that just because you are a human being, that doesn't give you worth and value. That doesn't give you the right to life. Instead, your worth or value is determined by your age, by how small you are, by what you're capable of doing. And by the same token, in a similar way, racism just arbitrarily decides that certain people are subhuman. In fact, to spell this point out very clearly, remember I showed you this statement from Justice Blackmun when he wrote Roe versus Wade? And just simply says the word person, as used in the 14th Amendment, does not include the unborn. And I pointed out to you last night, 100 years ago, a very similar move was made. When a slave named Dred Scott ran away from his masters and escaped into free territory and hoped to be set free, and instead he was going to be ordered back to his master, and the case went to the Supreme Court. And here's what the court said back in 1857. We think that black people are not included and were not intended to be included under the word citizens in the Constitution and can therefore claim none of the rights and privileges which that instrument provides. On the contrary, they were at that time considered subordinate and an inferior class of beings who had been subjugated by the dominant race and had no rights or privileges. So what both of these issues have in common is just sweeping aside someone's status as an image bearer of God, either in the case of abortion because of the age of the person in question, or in the case of slavery because of the color of the person in question. Even more infuriating is the fact that in our nation's history, there were those who attempted to justify this move by the appeal to Scripture. Here's one book that's been written on this topic. Noah's Curse, the Biblical Justification of American Slavery. Now you might be thinking, what in the world are they talking about? How could you possibly use the Bible to justify slavery? Well, here is the passage in mind. Do you remember the story in Genesis 9? After the flood, Noah plants a vineyard, and what happens? He celebrates too much. He's intoxicated, goes into his tent, and something happens with his son, Ham. It's not clear to me exactly what happens. Many people have theorized what takes place. But what the text says is that when Noah awoke from his wine and knew what his youngest son had done to him, he said, "Cursed be Canaan, a servant of servants shall he be to his brothers." And here was the reasoning used. In the family tree of Noah, his son, Ham, is the progenitor of the African peoples. And in Genesis 9, this is the logic of the argument, a curse was placed on the descendants of Ham to be slaves, and so therefore there were people in our country who said, therefore those who descend from the African peoples are under the curse of Noah and should be enslaved.
So what's the response we should make to this argument?
Well, you know, the number one rule of Bible study is always to read the Bible in terms of what it meant to the people it was written to. So what would this text have meant to ancient Israel? Well, the big clue here in verse 25 is, does Noah use the name of the actual son who came into the tent? He does not. He doesn't say, cursed be Ham. Instead, he says, cursed be one of Ham's sons, whose name just happens to be Canaan, as in the Canaanites, as in the nation that God is going to send Israel to punish and then to subjugate in the conquest. This is not a passage talking about American slavery. This is a passage talking about the history of Israel and what Israel will do in the conquest. But in any event, on the basis of thinking like this, there have always been people willing to try to justify, by the Bible even, notions of racial inferiority or superiority, and then slavery as a result. Here's the interesting thing, just to me as a side note about the Bible and racism. Actually, in the world of the Bible, racism itself was not much of an issue. Now, there were plenty of forms of prejudice, but in Bible times, prejudice happened to be more determined by things like your social standing. Were you a slave or free? Were you wealthy or poor? Or your ethnicity. Were you Greek, one of the sophisticated, or were you a barbarian? Or by religious standards, were you Jewish or were you Gentile? Or by gender, were you male or female? But actually, a fixation on race is unfortunately more of a new problem here in our culture than it certainly was in Bible times, although we can take what the Bible says about our status as image bearers and the sin of prejudice and apply them to the issue here in our country. And it is indeed an issue here in our country. In fact, it seems to me that racism has taken quite a radical turn in our country to become embedded in the political landscape by something known as identity politics. Now, what is identity politics? Well, it's the opposite of politics like what some of us remember a long time ago. Some of us a real long time ago. So you might remember, for example, FDR's famous New Deal coalition, in which he cobbled together a political coalition of farmers and inner city blacks and labor union members and put them all together and united them as a political force. A couple generations later, President Reagan had a coalition and it kind of cobbled together blue-collar workers and religious conservatives and free market libertarians and cold warrior anti-Russians, and he put together a coalition. And in, historically, in our country, that's kind of how it worked. You would get coalitions and bring people together. But now in our country, we are seeing something that is the exact opposite of this. Instead, people are forming exclusive alliances based on identities like what race you are, what gender you are, what sexual preference you are. And that is what is called identity politics. It happens on all sides of the political spectrum. There is, for example, white identity politics, which says that, listen, all of this stuff about a coalition with other people different than us, forget that. We need to be concerned about our white racial identity and realize that other people are threatening white civilization. Sometimes these people are called the alt-right because they see themselves as the alternate to what has been the traditional right. And the people that they especially dislike are people who call themselves Christians. Because after all, Christianity talks about things like loving your neighbor and doing good to others and showing love across racial and ethnic lines. And they think this is foolishness. One of these publications says, as Christianity lost prestige, more normal, healthy men have moved along to other pastures and forsaken any interest in church leadership positions. As a result, the entire apparatus of Western Christianity has largely been overtaken by beta girl men. Today, you have a bunch of beta males, often literal cuckolds, a derogatory term for a man whose wife cheats on him, who incessantly whine like little pansies. That's what they think of people who are trying to follow Jesus Christ. And just take a wild guess, going back to last night's lesson, what position they take on abortion. Here's one of their spokesmen, whose name is Richard Spencer. The people who are having abortions are generally very often black or Hispanic or people from very poor circumstances, to be honest. And so the anti-abortion crusade becomes this human rights crusade that every being that is a human has a right to life and so on. Well, that's not how we think as identitarians, to be honest. You're part of a community, you're part of a family, you're part of a collective. You do not have some human right, some abstract thing given to you by God. You're part of a community, and that's where you gain your meaning or your rights. So as far as he's concerned, the more black and Hispanic babies that are aborted, the better. Because in his twisted view of the world, all that matters is his identity as a white person. That's identity politics. Let me just make this point. There is a reason that the concept of individual human rights historically is connected with societies that believe there is one God. Because societies that do not believe there is one God, who believe in multiple gods or no gods, either have little enclaves of tribes that follow one god or the other and are at each other's throats, or they don't believe there's any kind of transcendent moral value at all, and they're even more at each other's throats. Cultures that believe there is one God believe that since there is one God, all of us are made in his image, and therefore all of us should treat each other appropriately. It is the reason why that as our culture loses a common sense of belief in God, that all of these old racial hatreds are starting to reemerge. Because the glue of belief in one God that can unite us all in the brotherhood of man, so to speak, is dissolving before our eyes. And what will take its place is ugly and brutal. Whether it comes from the right or whether it comes from the left. Identity politics is now a huge part of the political experience on the left side of the spectrum as well, like in the Black Lives Matter movement. Now, let me say something that is obvious. Black lives matter to Jesus Christ. And not only that, we as Christians who believe the civil authorities are supposed to be a minister of God to do justice should be the first people to cry out when we think there is injustice on the part of civil authority. Obviously. But you would have to be incredibly naive to think that's all the Black Lives Matter movement is concerned about. The Black Lives Matter movement is a full-on identity politics movement, which, if you go to its website, celebrates the fact that it is also queer-affirming and trans-affirming and explicitly says we are committed to disrupting the Western prescribed, translated, biblical nuclear family structure requirement. And in fact, what's happening on the left is the more oppressed identities you can link yourself to, so if, for example, you are black and you are trans and you are a woman, then that's 3 points in your favor, and if you can intersect those together in what is called intersectionality, that makes you more special than anybody else. It is an identity that is fixated on either race or gender or on sexual orientation that becomes a morbid preoccupation. And because of this morbid preoccupation with race, guess what is making a good old-fashioned comeback in our culture? Flat-out racism. Like, for example, on Huffington Post, this article: I'm an Asian woman engaged to a white man, and honestly, I'm struggling with that. Or this story from the New York Times: can my children be friends with white people? Or another New York Times editorial: I broke up with her because she is white. This fixation in our culture right now in identity politics, either from the right or from the left, to divide up into little enclaves, to stir up pride and hatred against others, is the very sort of thing the wise man warned about in Proverbs 6 when he says there are 6 things the Lord hates, 7 that are an abomination to him. haughty eyes, which is how it all begins, right? Pride. And a lying tongue, when you make wild accusations about others who are different than you. And hands that shed innocent blood, a heart that devises wicked plans, feet that make haste to run evil, a false witness who breathes out lies, and one who sows discord among brothers. We understand, though, as Christians, that our identity is not to be measured by our skin pigment. Although I have to say, having lived in Florida for a while, I finally have a good tan, so I'm kind of excited about that. But that means absolutely nothing. We don't find our identity in politics. We find our identity in Jesus Christ. We find our identity not in our nationality, because we know that our citizenship is in heaven. We find our identity not through our earthly families, but because we know we've been born not of flesh, but of the Spirit of God. We find our identity not in the physical race that we are part of, but because we understand we are part of a new humanity. Paul says in Colossians 3, do not lie to one another, seeing that you've put off the old self with its practices and have put on the new self, which is being renewed in knowledge after the image of its creator. God is once again going to make us the image bearers he all along intended through Christ. And in that new creation, he says, here there is not Greek and Jew, circumcised and uncircumcised, barbarian, Scythian, slave, and free. Now, once again, you'll notice that as Paul wants to talk about all the potential identities, white and black are missing here. Because, as I said, in the first century, that truly was not the way people thought. We've come up with that beautiful invention on our own here lately. But he does mention the ones that in his day and time were the source of hateful pride and prejudice. For example, Greek and Jew. Circumcised and uncircumcised, barbarian, Scythian. The Scythians in the first century were generally thought to be the very epitome of unrefinement and savagery. We call them West Virginians now. Now, I'm just teasing. That is, we have a couple of members from West Virginia now. I have to just get it in there every chance I get here. Well, you can see what Paul is saying, right? Look, I know, in his day and time, I know the kinds of things that sinful, vain human pride want to focus on, whether you're a Jew or a Greek. The Jews, of course, could be inordinately prideful because they thought they were God's chosen people. The Greeks could be inordinately prideful because they thought they were the focus of all civilization. Circumcised and uncircumcised, that religious dimension put into ritualistic practice. Barbarian and Scythian, your social class, slave or free. Paul says, I know that in our world, these are the things that we want to fixate on. If he was writing today, undoubtedly he would include race as a part of the mix. But here's what he says counts in the new creation of God. Here is what counts. Christ is all. That is your identity. Your identity is not white or black. Your identity is not ultimately American or a foreigner. Your identity is not primarily wealthy or poor or educated or uneducated. Your identity, Paul says, is Christ. He is all. He's all that counts. And he is in all. He is in all of us who are his people. And I will tell you this, in the first century and second century, where these class distinctions and ethnic distinctions did royal people in hatred, the impact of Christianity was enormous. In the second century, there was a writer named Tertullian who wrote an apology, a defense of Christianity in the face of a pagan world. And he says, you know, the pagans, they say a lot of hateful things about us, but here's one thing they also say. It is mainly the deeds of a love so noble that lead many to put a brand upon us. See, they say, how they love one another, for they themselves are animated by mutual hatred. See, they say about us how they are ready even to die for one another, for they themselves would sooner kill. A couple of weeks ago, I was preaching up in Chillicothe, Ohio, in the southeastern part of the state. It's the second time I've had a chance to go there. There are two members in that congregation. I wish now I had put a picture up from my visit last time so I could kind of show you this in person, but I'll just describe it for you. There are two members there. One is named Alfred Marcus. The other is named Brad Price. Alfred is a self-described former black militant. He grew up very much a part of the militant black nationalist movement. Brad is a former white supremacist. And I don't know if he was a Klan member or a part of one of those Aryan offshoot type groups. They both became Christians. And they worship together now in a congregation that has many examples over of that very diversity that I've just described to you. And you know what is so cool about that is Chillicothe has a lot of the problems that a lot of small towns in this general part of the world has. But when people walk into that church building and see that group of people together, they cannot help but say, see how they love one another. And you imagine the power that can bring a black nationalist and a white supremacist to sit at the Lord's table together. That's what we have to share with the world. And I tell you what my friends Alfred and Brad have learned. They've learned they are a new race. And brothers and sisters, you are as well. We are all a new race of people. This point is made by Paul at the end of 1 Corinthians 10. You remember this discussion. He's been talking about issues that have to do with when can you go to a temple now that you're a Christian? Can you still go to the pagan idols and to the banquets and all of those connections and questions that they had? And at the end of that whole discussion, he says this in verse 31. So whether you eat or drink, whatever you do, do all to the glory of God. It is the glory of God that determines all of our behavior. Listen, though, carefully to verse 32. Give no offense, and he gives three categories, to Jews or to Greeks or to, now wait a minute. I thought Jews and Gentiles, that pretty much is everybody, right? Wrong. There's one more category. The church of God. You see what Paul is saying here? There's actually three races, three ethnicities, three possible categories. Jew, Gentile, or Christian. And because you are a Christian, because you are a part of the church of the Lord Jesus Christ, you are no longer one of these. And that is why you and I, as this new race of people, can stand and we can call out racism whenever and wherever it happens, because those aren't our teams anymore. Our team is Jesus Christ. And so if we see something go down and it's a black person against a white person, we'll call it out. A white person against a black, we'll call it out. Doesn't make any difference who it is. The issue is, what did King Jesus say about the matter? Because it's Jesus that we want to please. It's Jesus that we want to serve. It's Jesus that we are now a part of. It is the race called Christian that we have now been adopted into by the Spirit of God and by the grace of God. And if we think like that, then we will follow Paul into saying in verse 33, as I try to please everyone and everything I do, not seeking my own advantage, but that of many, that they may be saved. Because as Gist led us tonight, the gospel is for all. And we should never underestimate the power of the gospel to change lives in these very sensitive, centuries-old rivalries I've been talking about tonight. Several years ago, someone recommended to me a book called 70 Years in Dixie. It was written way back at the end of the 1800s. It's reminiscence of a preacher about his experiences. Imagine what it would be like to have lived in the South and the things you would have seen change from, let's say, 1830 to 1900. Amazing changes. One of the things he talks about is his experience growing up with a mammy. Now, some of you maybe have never even read or heard that term, mammy. It refers to a black slave woman whose job it was to be a nanny, except she wasn't paid for it. She was a slave. It's a strange thing, though, that in that situation, there are countless stories of beautiful love that could develop. In the worst possible circumstance, right? Slavery. And yet there could be tender affection between the slave woman and the little children she was helping to raise. A lot of songs from that era are about how someone loves his mammy. So in this book, he talks about his mammy, his black mammy, and how kind she was and how good she was to him. I don't remember now. I'd have to go back and read the fuller story. I feel as if his actual mother passed away when he was a child, and so she really was very much like a surrogate mother to him. But he had great affection, great fondness for her. He moves away. He begins to take interest in a young lady. And maybe he even gets engaged. I don't remember all the details. But he brings her back to the old home where his black mammy still lives. She's very excited to see him because she had great affection for him. It's just one of the tender mercies of God that even in horrible circumstances, love can still find its way through. But so she sees him come home, and in her eagerness and happiness, she runs and puts her arms around him to hug him and kiss him. But he gets embarrassed because it's in front of his new woman, and he pushes her away. Sends her away. And then later, he reflects on what he did. And he writes this. When I think how I blushed to be kissed and loved by one who had so nobly earned her right to a mother's attention and privileges, by all she had done for me during my helpless infant orphanage, it was mean and contemptible in me. And then he says this. But I will yet atone for it in a measure if I am so fortunate as to meet her ransomed soul on the glory-gilded shore of eternity. In that sweet by and by, I will walk right up to her. And if her face is as wrinkled and black as it was when I last saw it, I will nevertheless throw my arms around her neck and before God, Christ, the angels, and assembled universe, tenderly press a loving, repentant kiss upon her cheeks. It's beautiful. That's grace. That's the power of Jesus Christ. And brothers and sisters, that's what we have to offer to this world of hatred. I told you on Sunday morning, one of the stories that more and more is starting to come home to me is the story of the Good Samaritan. And that you and I, in the midst of a culture that is unraveling, are going to encounter many wounded people along the way. And of course, the beautiful thing about that story is the Samaritan, far as we know, doesn't know anything about the guy he helps. Probably there's a pretty good chance he thinks he's Jewish, but he doesn't care, because he knows what the love of a neighbor is supposed to be. And you and I are in a world in which the kind of racial and identity-based hostility that I've talked about tonight is going to wound more and more people. And you and I can be there for them. We can be there for them with the gospel and with the love of God and show them what a neighbor truly is. Tonight, it might be that you do not have an identity that is centered on Jesus Christ. Maybe your identity is focused on something else. What a foolish mistake that is. We want you to see that Jesus Christ is all and in all. He's all that counts. He's in all of us who follow him. If you need to become a Christian tonight through your faith and trust in Jesus' death, through your union with him in baptism, we would love to help you do that. And certainly to help you as a child of God to live like him and for him. Why don't you let us know how we can help while we stand and sing together.